Maybe we'll start. Bonjour. Je suis Rosella Melançon. I'm Rosella Melançon. I'm with the Advisory Council on the Status of Women. We're one of the sponsors here today. Welcome to another in our series of Lunch and Learns. I think this is the one that filled up most quickly, the fastest of all the Lunch and Learns we've done over the years. The food is the same, so it must be the issue is a hot topic. We were saying, we could have been 300 here because we stopped doing publicity and still the requests were coming in and we've had a waiting list. We hope to hold other Lunch and Learns or sessions on workplace bullying in other regions of the province and in both languages in the fall, so watch out for that information. The Advisory Council did a bit of work on workplace bullying last year. We did a bit of research, and in order to ensure that what we recommended was right, was effective, we decided to hold focus groups last fall. We placed newspaper ads which read, "Are you a woman who has been or is currently a victim of workplace bullying?" And within 2 days, we had 60 replies, and we didn't have to run the ads again. And we had 45 women who participated in focus groups in four areas of the province, and we also did several interviews. The women told us that the mechanisms that are available to them now are not only ineffective, but sometimes make the problem worse. They told us they felt the greatest shortcomings in the mechanism is that they don't have teeth and that the person that they're supposed to consult is sometimes not helpful and not part of the problem, or is part of the problem, sorry. And there was consensus that public education was as important as legislation in this issue, just putting a name to the problem. And in that in that vein, we just received, we put them on the front table here, the province of New Brunswick has proclaimed this week as a Respectful Workplace Week. Norma Dubé of Women's Issues Branch just arrived with the proclamation signed by the Premier, and you can get a copy there. It puts the issue very well, and it proclaims the week of September 3rd to 9th as Respectful Workplace Week in New Brunswick. As a result of the work we, the Advisory Council, did last year, we recommended that government should amend legislation in New Brunswick to recognize workplace bullying as a workplace health issue, is how we started to think about it, to provide protection and assure redress for victims, including advice to victims, complaint procedures, tough penalties for employers who tolerate it, and follow-up to ensure the problem has been rectified, because a lot of the participants in our focus groups talked about, yeah, so-and-so or a mediator or somebody issued something, but it was never done, and there was still a problem. We also recommended that government should ensure that enforcement and public education are supported by adequate human and material resources, not enough to have a law, you need to enforce it. And that we should assist employers in developing prevention policies and codes of conduct to provide information and support to victims also. And as an employer, government should investigate the extent of bullying in the public sector and take measures to eliminate it. Like I said, we had put the ads in the newspaper, not relied on email. We were surprised at the number of women who were coming forward who were working for government, federal and provincial, and for the health sector. It's not scientific. We don't know if it means there's more of a problem there, but basically also it means that we were looking for women, and those are the sectors where women are working. If we were doing sessions with men, it might be a different story. The summary of the Advisory Council's position paper on workplace bullying was on the table there. You probably picked it up because there's none left. And it's on our website, of course. Now, we're here to hear from Marilyn Noble, our local expert on the issue. Marilyn is known to a lot of you. She's a community-based adult educator and facilitator. She founded the Nurturing Ourselves, UNB's annual conference on women's well-being, now entering its 18th year this fall. She's been She's been a host and community producer for a television series, Positive Parenting. You'll probably have seen that too. For the past 6 years, she's been involved in bullying reduction, both among children and youth and in the workplace. She's project coordinator and community co-chair for UNB's research team on workplace violence and abuse, or workplace bullying. And she's developed and teaches 2 degree credit courses at UNB, Bridging Difference, Diversity and Inclusion in Adult Learning, and The Respectful Workplace, Principles and Practices. She leads learning days for Leadership Fredericton on diversity and inclusion and facilitating groups. Marilyn.
Thank you, Rosella. It's an enormous pleasure to be here, and I have to say it's a good news, bad news story when you see this many people come out for this topic. We're delighted to make it discussable and delighted that you came to find out more about it. It's a shame that we have to be talking about it. So I just want to say that right up front. The work that I've been involved in around workplace bullying began actually with a conversation with a colleague. And I was at the time working on child and youth bullying issues and was beginning to see a lot of material in the literature that talked about bullying in the workplace. And the colleague was Joy Mighty in the Faculty of Business Administration at UNB, with whom I had worked on another conference on family violence as a workplace issue. She had been encountering the same kind of literature, and we decided it was time to do something about it, so we formed a team. And our approach in doing that was to recruit a group of women who, over the preceding 5 years, had told me at some point a story about the job from hell. We wanted people who had been there, who were really committed to doing something about this issue. And over the first 4 years of our work, there were 15 women who came and went on our team, a total of 15 people who participated at various points in time. It's an interesting part of the story that 8 of them left, not because of anything that happened on the team, but because of stress leave, chronic illness that was stress-related, changing jobs, moving to another community because of work, retiring early because of work. It's almost a sociological mini-study of what goes on with this issue. So we found that kind of a telling thing. In the beginning, we shared our own stories, because trying to describe this problem is a little bit like nailing jelly to the wall. It can take so many different forms. And sometimes we don't recognize it as what it is. I think often people do not recognize this problem until they start to have physical symptoms, or until a colleague or a third party says to them, you know, what just happened to you was totally inappropriate. He shouldn't have said that to you, or she shouldn't have done that. That was just totally wrong. So sometimes we need that validation from another person. I think often we internalize it. We think we must be screwing up somehow, or this wouldn't be happening to us. Or we must be defective in some way, or we wouldn't be the target. And that's a huge part of the issue for many of us. So I think it's enormously important that we do this kind of public education. The other reason I believe the public education piece is so crucial is that when this happens to somebody at work, the first person they talk to is probably going to be a significant other. It will be a friend, a family member, so we need the whole community to be on board with this issue, to recognize it, to know the symptoms, and to have some sense of what to do about it. So I think it's great that you're here, whether you're here on your own behalf or on behalf of somebody that you know. It's very important that you inform yourself. Now, I could give you a long, wordy definition. There's one in the little rectangular box on the handout that you picked up. It's wordy. I'm going to boil it down for you. A shorter phrase that would describe it quite nicely is personal diminishment. Things that make us feel bad about who we are, people who make us feel incompetent, ashamed, worthless, excluded, and even unsafe. So try to keep that in your head as part of the definition. I think we're approximately at the point with this issue that the family violence issue was 25 years ago. I think we've brought it out of the closet, we're naming it, and we're making it discussable. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a very crucial starting point, that we be able to talk openly about what's going on. Now, we have a predominantly female audience today, but I don't want to leave you with the impression that this does not involve men either. And they're not always the bullies. Women also bully, men also get bullied. So I just want to balance that off for you too. The work that we've been doing, I told you about our initial discussions within our team. Then in 2004, we decided that we would hold focus groups or learning circles in three communities in New Brunswick. And there's several stories behind that too. We held one in Fredericton, had a huge response, had to put on a second one. A lot of very feisty civil servants who were really ready to talk about this issue. We tried to hold one in Miramichi and couldn't get a flicker of response. And somebody in that community said to me, you know, this is a blue-collar community. It's so much part of the culture that people don't recognize it, and they certainly wouldn't question or challenge it. You know, do fish see water? When you're immersed in it, it's very hard to get that distance and see it for what it is. In St. John, we had 8 people who agreed to come to the learning circle and only 3 who actually turned up that night. And what people had said to our research assistant on that one was that there was too high a likelihood of running into somebody you knew, somebody who was related to the bully at work, that the word would get back. There was really a high level of fear about that. And people had said they would do a one-on-one interview, but a focus group is too much like going public. Now, of course, the reason we did focus groups is that part of the problem with workplace bullying is that it's very isolating. That's how the bully gets to you. They cut you off from everybody. So we thought it would be important to have that validation of speaking with other people. And in fact, participants in those learning circles, in some cases, voiced the wish to have that go on as a support group. They really enjoyed having that opportunity to connect with other people who were going through the same thing. So that's part of it too. Now, more recently, in the last 14 months, sorry, I'm making funny noises here. In the last 14 months, we went on to the next phase of our research, and that involved interviews with 29 managers. In public sector, private sector, not-for-profit organizations, and unions who had responsibility for managing this issue in their workplaces. So those key informant interviews took place over the summer and fall of this past year. And then we brought a smaller group of those people together for 5 co-facilitated group discussions across workplaces, to compare some of the more difficult to resolve issues and to talk about strategies. And my co-facilitator is sitting in the second row. Marvin, do you want to just wave to them? So we have moved on to looking at it from a managerial point of view and to trying to get organizations on board with addressing this issue. Now, I'm going to speak today primarily from the first study, because I'm assuming that most of you probably are here from a personal point of view or being on the receiving end of it. If there are some of you who want to talk about the managerial side of it, I can certainly address those questions too. But I thought I would start with the personal experience side of things. Now, I'm going to give you some examples of the kinds of stories that we heard. I recall 2 men in 2 separate focus groups who were trying really hard to be the good, motivational, supportive, humanistic manager, to recognize people had other demands on their lives, other demands on their time, and tried very hard to be compassionate bosses, to make sure people had the resources they needed to do their jobs, that they found some joy and some satisfaction in their work. Sounds pretty ideal, doesn't it? They got bullied by the next level up in the food chain who said, where's the control and coercion? That's not how we do things here. You're not squeezing your people hard enough. And that really stuck with me. That really was a pretty sad commentary. I also recall a woman who had gone back to school to learn a new field of work. She ended up in a two-person operation. There was her and there was the bully. Didn't give her adequate resources or training, gave her too much responsibility too soon, had an explosive temper, was a very scary person to deal with, and she had nowhere to go. There's no human resources department in a two-person operation. What do you do? So that was a tough one. I also recall people talking, and this was fairly common, about doing the C-check when you went into work first thing in the morning. You kind of got a feeling whether the bully was in a bad mood today. And you sort of knew whether you were going to walk on eggshells all day. And you knew right away if the bully wasn't there because people talked, they laughed, they had a good time. They weren't goofing off, but the air was palpably lighter. And then there was a fellow in one group who talked about taking a long drive home from work in order to decompress before he got home. And he talked about how he had thought more than once about just driving off that bridge on the way home because it had driven him to that point of desperation. So this really affects people's lives. And it goes home with them, too. It can't help but go home with them. And sometimes, as family members, we're not sure what to do about it. We can't really get an accurate gauge of whether they're, you know, is everybody picking on them or are they paranoid? It's hard to tell. And sometimes people get tired of hearing about it. And sometimes family members will say, well, why don't you just quit the damn job? But we all know in this economy that you don't just quit the damn job, that, you know, you have other pressures in your lives. You have bills to pay and mortgages and all that stuff. So we need to be very careful how we listen to people when this is going on. It's very critical that everybody have a good, reliable sounding board and a reality check who can help them determine whether what is going on is out of the normal range. And then we have to figure out what to do about it. So I just want to talk now, and I also want to make very clear that it is not only bosses who bully. Let's lay that myth to rest. You can be bullied by coworkers. You can be bullied by a subordinate. There may be a receptionist or a secretary who withholds all your urgent personal messages, tampers with your workstation, might even make that report you've been working on 6 months disappear from your computer just when you're supposed to deliver the report. There are all kinds of ways that people undermine one another. And there's also a dynamic that goes on in workplaces. There are different forms that this takes. Sometimes it's person to person. It's just one person picking on one person. Now, they may have a whole string of one people that they pick on. They may be a serial bully. But they may target one person at a time. It may be one person bullying a whole group. Well, that's manageable because at least the group have each other for support. But imagine how you feel if you're one person being bullied by a whole group. That's called mobbing. And that is really devastating for people. They have nowhere to turn. You have absolutely no idea who it's safe to talk to or what you can do about it. And then we have work environments where the whole thing, all of the assumptions about normal civilized behavior go to hell in a handcart, and you end up with a toxic workplace where everybody is uncomfortable, uneasy, and there's a really bad feeling about the place. So think about those four different scenarios. They play out quite differently. They have common elements, of course, but you can imagine the impact would be quite different. Now, what kinds of behavior are we really talking about? Well, let me just refresh your mind about the list here. Berating someone in front of others. Withholding information and resources. Setting you up to fail, effectively. Sexist, racist, or homophobic comments. Unpredictable and explosive outbursts. Imposing unsafe working conditions. I would consider it bullying when you have a young person who's hired to work at a convenience store and they're expected to work the night shift alone. Imposing impossible deadlines and expectations. You know, suddenly you're on call 24/7. Remember when they told us 30 years ago that technology was going to give us all that free time? What a crock that turned out to be. So now you have your cell phone, you have your Palm Pilot, you have, you know, all that stuff. You're on call all the time. And if people send you an email, they expect you to respond right away, just because it's an email. Well, there's an artificial urgency that sets in there. And some of us really get hooked into that. My theory about this is that unless you were an emergency worker, you should not have an umbilical cord to your office 24/7. You should not have to take calls when you were outside your working hours. And I think we've really got to rein in on that one. Okay, taking credit for another person's ideas. Rudeness and abusive language. Scapegoating and constant fault finding. Pickety, 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 pick. Hounding staff outside of office hours, we've talked about. Rumors, gossip, and innuendo. And finally, threats and intimidation. So that just kind of gives you the flavor of the range of things. Where does it happen? Well, any workplace that doesn't take precautions to make sure it doesn't is potentially a place where it can happen. Do I think all workplaces are awful? No, of course not. But it can happen in two-person offices, in helping agencies and not-for-profit organizations, educational institutions, hospitals, churches, small businesses, large organizations, government departments, unionized and non-unionized settings. They all have that potential. Now, there's another thing I think it's useful to say right at the beginning about the climate in a workplace. I'm going to describe two extreme ends of a spectrum to you, and you're going to imagine that there are all sorts of gradations in between. In one workplace, we have what I call the climate of safety for risk-taking. So when there is a mistake, a conflict, or a negative workplace event, we can talk about it. We have an honest, open discussion aimed at trying to learn how we can avoid having that problem again, or how we can clear the air, how we can address it appropriately. On the other end of the spectrum, we have the duck and cover climate, where mistakes, conflicts, and negative workplace events are swept under the rug until eventually the rug bulges. And because we haven't taken the trouble to learn from them, they fester, they sink deeper, they spread, it gets worse. So you see the difference in those two environments and why it's important to be able to talk about these things when they happen. The other piece of advice that I think is really important is that when you begin to sense that you're being bullied, if somebody's behavior really seems inappropriate and is making you uncomfortable, then you need to address it as soon as you recognize it. Early recognition and early intervention allow you to do it at a fairly low level. You don't have to bring in the cavalry. You can do it in a fairly gentle way. Now, a colleague from Montreal taught me this little technique, and I'm just going to describe how I used it about a week later, and I found it worked like a charm. I was serving on a national committee, and I had gone to one of my meetings, and I was put on a little working group with three other people. One of them, the man who didn't hear women, and he was also something I respected about him was that he was a very careful wordsmith, but he did not tend to hear the things that women said. I didn't know that about him when I walked into this working group, but I found out in a hurry. There was a man who was new to the committee, and there was a black woman who was on the staff of this organization. So we had our discussion. I was tasked to be the facilitator. That had been predetermined. He was to have been the recorder, but he was confronted with a laptop, and it made him uncomfortable, so he gave that job to the other man. the person who was the major contributor and said the most significant things in that discussion was the black woman. And when we went back and we were asked to give the report, I turned to the I'm trying to think exactly how it was phrased. Anyway, the man who had been at the laptop was about to give the report, and the other man who didn't hear women said, well, of course, I mean, he did all the work. So he gave the report, and it was as though the black woman and I hadn't been in the room. And she and I looked at each other like, were we really at the same meeting? So we contributed what we needed to in the plenary discussion, and then after the meeting that night, several hours later, I went over to him and I said, you know, you've been with this organization much longer than I have, and there's a lot I could learn from you, and I'd like to be able to do that. But right now, there is something getting in the way of my being able to do that. There's a problem in our working relationship. Could we talk? Well, yes, no problem. So we went off to a corner, and I told him essentially what I've just told you. I described the behavior. I described the impact that it had had on the two of us. And he was horrified. There was no denial. He didn't say, oh my God, I certainly didn't do that. No, quite the contrary. He said, oh my God, I hope I don't do that in other settings. I'm so sorry. He went very deep with it, actually. He then said, is there some way you could tell me when I'm doing that? Can you signal me some way so that I won't? So we worked that out, and I said, you know, equally, if there's something I do that annoys you, will you please let me know? And we went back to our meeting the next day, and we were doing one of these wordsmithing exercises, and I made a suggestion about how something should be phrased, and he was trying to be a good listener. He jumped right up and made sure it got noted on the flip chart. So it doesn't have to be a big deal. Now, you can make that attempt and people may blow you off, but at least you've made the attempt. And sometimes, if you catch it early enough, it will be enough. So let me just review the steps. Find something authentically positive you can say about this person. Frame it so that it is your shared issue. It is not your problem. It is a problem that the two of you share. So you have to hook them into having the conversation with you. Be specific about the behavior. Be specific about its impact. And then talk about how the change is going to be made. Saying something positive about the person and about why you value that relationship. And you can't make it up. Because they'll know if you did. Okay? So that's a strategy that you might find helpful. Now, people also will find, by the way, that they may be bullied by forces outside the organization. Sometimes if you're working in the public sector or dealing with the public, you may feel bullied by the public, by your clients, sometimes by the media. Sometimes you feel bullied by the system itself. Maybe there are very unfortunate things about the way change is implemented. And I've been reading things lately about people who are tasked, managers who are tasked with overseeing downsizing. And the article that I read about that was called The Reluctant Executioners. And it talked about the impact on managers of having to play that kind of role, that the only other people you can talk to at work are other people who have to do the same dirty work of doing the downsizing. Nobody else wants to talk to you. And you carry it around with you, so you withdraw at home, too. And sometimes home is not very comforting. And there may be a certain feeling at home that what you're doing is not what you should be doing. So there are things like that that happen within larger systems that contribute to the problem. Now, the impact on targets, we've talked about internalizing it and thinking that you must be the defective piece. There's the erosion of self-confidence, there's anxiety, there's even hypervigilance. You're just constantly on red alert. Well, you don't get a lot of work done when you're worried about how you're going to be treated. There's loss of energy, social withdrawal and isolation, burnout, physical illness, post-traumatic stress disorder, despondency, depression and despair, and homicide and suicide sometimes ensue. For organizations, the impact is equally great. There's a drop in productivity. There's not only absenteeism, but also presenteeism. You're there, but your head isn't. Sick leave, stress leave, long-term disability, staff turnover, litigation, loss of consumer confidence, and difficulty in attracting new employees once the word gets out that you're a toxic workplace, or that you don't want to have to work for that person. So why don't organizations do something about it? Well, sometimes they're not sure what to do. They're afraid if they do the wrong thing, they'll really make a mess of it. Sometimes the bully is in a very protected place. They're either very high in the hierarchy or they have very specialized skills that would be hard to replace. So people just tippy-toe around the bully. There are other kinds of concerns too. I think just that you don't know how to clean it up in a way that's fair. It looks like it's going to be very expensive and very time-consuming, and yes, it probably will be. That's why you want to stop it before it gets to that point. That's why you want to create a positive environment. Quick speculation about what lies behind workplace bullying. I think there are a couple of primary things. One is issues around power and control, and the other is contempt for difference. And I think those are both part and parcel of what goes on when people get bullied at work. How does it compare with child and youth bullying? Well, we know that when kids get bullied at school, it's often because they're different in some way, so that piece is common. The literature on child and youth bullying tends to say there are three definitional factors. One is a power differential. Somebody older, stronger, bigger, smarter, a group, or somebody in authority picking on somebody relatively vulnerable. There is the intent to harm, and there's the threat that it will continue to escalate. What we're not so sure about with workplace bullying is that there is an intent to harm. Now let me explain that. You perceive it as harm when you're on the receiving end, no question. Your perception's your reality. You are being harmed. But the person who is inflicting the damage many times does it unwittingly. Now picture it. Somebody has control over you because they can hire or fire you. So you suck it up. You don't tell them about it. And if you don't tell them about it, they have no opportunity to self-correct. The other thing that happens when that occurs is that you suck it up for so long and then it hits a threshold where you can't anymore and you blow up. And then the bully wonders where you're coming from because they see it as one incident. And it was probably a minor incident that finally made the cup overflow, when in fact for you it's been a long ongoing pattern that you have tolerated for much too long. So again, the sooner you recognize it, the sooner you address it, the better. And sometimes in the work setting, the person who gets bullied is someone who is very competent, very well liked, and has a very high sense of integrity. And they may be threatening to a supervisor who is less educated, less skilled, less current, may not have a particularly appealing personality, and that can create its own issues. There is also the risk that the person I've described as the potential target may be a whistleblower. If there's something unethical going on in the workplace, there may be a fear that they will blow the whistle on what's happening. Now, I just wanted to talk very briefly on the impact on the target's family, because some of you will probably be experiencing it from that vantage point. You really need to be there as a sounding board. And it's very hard on this person when you don't get it. You just don't understand what they're going through. As you hear about it and begin to believe in the credibility of what they're telling you, sometimes you feel very helpless and very frustrated because you don't know what to do with it. And the target may become increasingly withdrawn and isolated. That may be very difficult to cope with. You get tired of hearing about it because it's the only topic of conversation. What you need to do is to try to inform yourself as you're doing today so that you can play an advocacy role to help that person. And with both adults and kids, I see absenteeism, the sick leave, stress leave thing. I've seen adults quit their job either because they're being bullied at work or because their child is being bullied at school. They may end up going out on stress leave or moving to another community. So there are serious repercussions for all of this. Yet people tend to ignore workplace bullying, hoping that it's their imagination and it will go away, that tomorrow it will be all better and this won't happen again. But you need to be realistic about it. When it does continue to happen, then you need to address it. Now, one really critical piece that I need to talk about is bystanders. These are the people who observe the bullying going on. Bullying affects everybody in the workplace, whether they're doing it, whether they're on the receiving end, or whether they're just there in that environment. Now, what I'm going to describe to you comes from the work of two people. First, I'm going to talk about Dan Olveus, a Norwegian who has been working on this issue for 2 decades. His work initially was around child and youth bullying. Now he's looking at the workplace. And I've renamed his categories to put it in plain language, but here's how we go. This is a spectrum of bystander behavior. First, we have the bully's henchmen or sidekicks who help do the dirty work. Any speculation about why somebody might choose to be a henchman? Yeah, it's about buying protection. You'd rather be on the bully's good side. And sometimes you're kind of a bad guy wannabe, but you're not quite brave enough to be the leader. I mean, it could be either of those. Okay, then we have the cheering section. Oh man, live entertainment, bring it on! Then we have what I hope would be the largest group, the deer caught in the headlights. Oh, this makes me so uncomfortable. I hate it when this happens, but I don't know what to do, and I'm afraid if I do something, I'll be next. Then we have the witnesses. They will go and get somebody in authority and say, there is a situation here that you need to deal with. And the last group are the defenders. Those are those people who are comfortable enough in their own skin that they will step up beside the target and say, hey, you come hang out with us, you don't need this. That would be the playground version, or the workplace version is, I'm here with you if you need me. And you're doing two things. You are lending support to the target without rescuing them and making them feel that they have to be rescued, disempowering them further. You are lending support to them, and you are also putting the bully on notice that you're watching. Now, a story was shared with me that has now made it across the country and into the states, actually. Reader's Digest even quoted and researched this story. It's Code Pink. Now, this is about a hospital in St. John where there was an anesthesiologist with a horrendous temper. He was really a vindictive, nasty, awful person. He threatened nurses. He told them they better watch where they put their car in the parking lot because he was going to get them after work. He had broken a patient's jaw once when the patient was coming out of anesthesia and was flailing around. He was known for reaming people out verbally, both patients and staff. He was abusive in every sense. And nothing was being done. These nurses couldn't take it anymore, so they banded together and they decided that whenever he was on a rant, they would call a code pink. It was named for their OR scrubs. And they said what code pink meant was that if you were available, you were to come and stand as a silent witness to what was going on. So picture him, he's frothing at the mouth, he's turning the air blue, and he looks up, and there's this group of people just standing watching him. Well, it shut him down. It was very effective as an episodic response. Now, it wasn't solving the problem in the long term because you still had those outbursts. And eventually a colleague saw him in action. Another member of the medical fraternity saw him behaving the way he tended to behave with the nursing staff and the patients. And he was reported to the hospital and he lost his hospital privileges. I wish I could go on to tell you what should have happened next had happened, and that would have been reporting him to the College of Physicians and Surgeons. Instead, he's landed in another hospital. I think so. I'm not sure of that. I'm really not sure. I'm not privy to those details. But you certainly would notice a lack of bedside manner, yes. That's true. Anyway, the important thing about that story is that you don't always have to wait for the system to respond. There are informal ways of handling it too, and it's about taking collective action and simply refusing to accept that kind of behavior. Now, clearly, there's a point at which there's another order of reporting and action that's required. So let's go back a few steps to what you need to do as an individual if you see this kind of situation brewing. You're going to find a sounding board, somebody that you know it's safe to talk to who isn't going to run back to the boss and tell them. So you need somebody to help you see whether there's something that you're missing in this situation. You know, they may hear your story and say, well, you know, have you noticed that it seems to be when you do this that you set them off? Or maybe you shouldn't have quite said it to him that way. So you need to have somebody who can help you figure that part out, who can help you detect a pattern. And you also need to keep really careful records. What does record keeping include? Well, any written memos, any voicemail messages, any email messages, written notes of any encounters that were bullying episodes and who might have heard or seen what went on, times, dates, places, and please do not keep this file at work. Keep it in a safe place where this person will not have access to it. And then if you need at some point to take legal action, you are equipped to do that because you can be very specific. It's not good enough to describe a general pattern of behavior. You have to be able to give dates, times, places, what happened, who did what. And at the informal level, we've talked about Code Pink, but you can also try to lobby to get this on your organization's agenda. If you don't already have a health and safety committee or a wellness committee or a labor management committee that can address this kind of thing, then you need to form some kind of a group that will look at the issue. You need to find ways to make it safe to talk about this among the parties who need to hear it. At the organizational level, and we're beginning to get calls from organizations to go in and work with them around this stuff. When I do, the first thing that I try, if I'm asked to go in and do a short workshop, the first thing I try to do is to get a sense of what kinds of things are happening. And I will write them up in little 3 or 4 sentence scenarios. I will give them the kind of talk that I've just given you, and then I will break them into small groups to discuss those scenarios, to analyze what's going on here, what needs to happen, and to brainstorm solutions. We need to prepare in that way, just as we prepare for fire drills and all that other kind of stuff, so that we're ready when it happens. That we won't be deer caught in the headlights, that we will have some idea of how to tackle it. And if you can find a group of like-minded people in your workplace with whom to have those conversations as a readiness measure, then I think that's a very positive thing to do. There needs to be commitment from the top of the organization and also from the bottom. It needs to work from both levels. We say about kid bullying that kids see all the stuff that is happening below the waterline. The adults only see the tip of the iceberg. And it's true in a workplace. Senior management doesn't know everything that's happening on the shop floor. So we have to make it safe for people to report, and we have to give them ways in which, a variety of ways in which they can do that. and some safe people to whom they can come, trusted people within the organization they can come to with a problem and seek some advice. We have to let people know what behavior is acceptable in our workplace and what isn't. Now, you may think that's common sense, but you know, common sense is an oxymoron. It's not so common. And sometimes people really need to be told quite specifically what they can and can't do in a workplace. When you have new people arrive in your organization, you need to have some kind of an orientation. And it takes more than just a staff handbook. Those are the official rules. We all know there's a gap between the official rules and how things really get done here. And there needs to be somebody who can coach them on that other level of how things really get done here. And you have to be looking at how things are really getting done and seeing whether it's ethical, whether it's open, supportive, inclusive, or is there some underhanded and really unfair stuff going on? Making it safe to report inappropriate conduct is really crucial. And then an organization may tell you they have a policy and they have procedures in place, but it's my suspicion at this point in our work that quite often those policies and procedures are up here and most of the problem is down here. So you need to see whether it's an appropriate match between the kinds of behaviors that are happening in the workplace and the measures that you have in place to address it. We also need, I think, to build in diversity competence. And that's going to become increasingly true. We're going through a process in New Brunswick with the Population Growth Secretariat of trying to increase diversity within our workplaces. And that isn't just ethnocultural diversity. There are many other forms of diversity, some of them hidden. And among the hidden things, I would include things like, whether you come from an urban or a rural background, whether there are mental health issues or substance abuse issues or family violence issues in your world. There are a whole lot of other forms of diversity, values and beliefs, what your religious upbringing has been, what your political views are, all of that comes with you to the workplace. So we have to learn how to work with people who don't see the world the way we do. And to realize that we don't have the gold standard, that the other person's views are perfectly legitimate for them, and that we need to find some common ground. There is, by the way, a diversity competence program that's been produced for workplaces by the Multicultural Council of New Brunswick. And you might want to access them if your organization needs help in that area. Another thing that's really a bitter pill for people to swallow, when they go to the point of having a situation investigated, the person who brings a complaint really wants the investigator to say, you were totally in the right and that person was totally in the wrong. Well, I've interviewed investigators too. And they say it's very rare that it's that clear cut. Everybody needs to be willing to look at their behavior and review how they may have contributed to the dynamics, and that includes the bystanders. It isn't to say that everybody plays an equal part, but we have to see how we may have allowed something to happen. It's important as well that there be people in the workplace who can provide training, coaching, counseling to people who need to undergo behavior change. And of course, as the old joke goes, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. So you're going to have some bullies who will remain in denial, and it will be very hard to get them to do things differently. However, if they realize how many people in the organization they have impacted, then you may get to the point that they will see the light, no pun intended. Procedures need to be practical. They need to be easy to implement. You don't want to have to look up 45 pages in the policy manual every time there's an incident. It needs to be clear-cut, simple, straightforward, and fair. And you need to provide protection to people who are accused, just as you do to people who are bringing the complaints. And you have to remember that policies are living documents.
They have to be reviewed periodically as circumstances in the workplace change, and you have to make sure that you keep them updated.